we begin to look at chapter 1. Kind of a modern idea of a goad might be what you hear some people saying in birthday parties, you know, grief, misery, and despair, people dying everywhere, but happy birthday, you know, that kind of thing. You know what that is? That's a goad. That's people saying, everybody's dying, and you're dying, and you're 1 year closer to dying. That's a goad. Ecclesiastes is kind of a difficult book to outline because it seems to go in and out of different themes. But as I mentioned, I think we can look at it best understood by four different discourses. And discourse one is this, the secret of pleasure in life. And I want to look, beginning here in the first several verses of chapter one, on Solomon's misery. He's been, now remember, this is written probably at the pretty much the close of Solomon's life, after he has tried a lot of things and it hasn't delivered the goods for him. And he mentions in verses 1 to 3 how he experienced great emptiness. Verse 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man in all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Now, vanity, as your notes say there, means all activities are filled with emptiness. And the Hebrew word, hebel, there, isn't always a bad term, the word emptiness, but its context determines whether it's bad or not. It simply means empty. And the primary goad to be hammered home in Ecclesiastes is that for a man to be truly wise, he has to see that all of life is vanity without God at the center of his life. Now, when we say empty, it doesn't mean that it's hopeless. That is not what this word necessarily means. In a context, it can mean hopeless. It simply means empty. It's like if we had a canvas up here that somebody was going to paint on, we would look at that canvas with nothing on it and say, that's empty. Now, that's not a problem, necessarily. It's just empty. It just means there's nothing there. And it takes someone then to do something with that. And the whole point of Solomon is saying, your life is like that canvas. No matter what you try to put on it, it will still be empty unless God does something in it. You can paint on it, you can stomp on it, you can throw all of your activities at it, you can throw all your entertainment at it, but it's still going to be empty. The only thing that's going to count is if God puts anything on that painting, on that canvas. All that you can do is put on something, it's still going to be empty. Whatever you put on, it's still going to be empty. Now, it is that sense that life is empty. It doesn't necessarily mean hopeless. Now, if you look at your life and you've been smattering stuff at your canvas and there's nothing forming up there, you might look at that in despair because of its emptiness. But just because it's empty is not a bad thing. It just means somebody has to write something on it. The Creator has to do something with everything for it to be enjoyed. We're going to see that theme. And if you ignore the Creator God and relationship with Him, daily relationship with Him, your life is supposed to be empty. I mean, that's a promise from Him. Without me, you can do not very much. That's not what He says. Life is going to be empty. Nothing will be painted of any value unless I do it. So vanity or emptiness is not necessarily a negative thing. It's just a statement of fact, but it can be. But he goes on, and he found in this, however, the negative twist to it, is that nothing is profitable. In verse 3, he says, what profit hath a man of his labor which he taketh under the sun? Verse 8, all things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. And the implied statement is, what's the point? And that is the point. This is echoing Matthew 16:26, or Matthew 16:26 echoes this, that what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? The canvas is still empty unless God does something with it. And we're going to see that phrase, nothing is profitable, come out several times. And not only is nothing profitable, nothing is permanent. And here he mentions a couple of things. Again, he's goading his audience. He's saying, all right, now remember, he's writing this, so to speak, evangelistic tract and to these Gentile philosophers, and he's saying, all right, now let's consider some things. I want to see what you make of all of this. First of all, he says, life is brief. Verses 4 to 7, let's read those. He says, one generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. and you don't really make a very big splash, is what he's saying. Okay, so you think you're big stuff, you die, and somebody else comes along, and they don't even remember who you are. But the earth is here, and it just keeps being here and being here, and you're not a very big splash in this puddle. So what's the point? Verse 5, the sun also, and I said, look at the earth. The sun ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth according to its circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. He's saying, life is very brief. You're not here very long, but old man river, she just keeps rolling along. You know, that's right there in the Hebrew text, if you want to check that out. It's kind of like he's saying, you can build your sandcastle on the beach. New sandcastle, never been there before. But the tide's going to come in and wash it all away. And it's not going to be there anymore. You put out great effort, marvelous creativity, amazing work of art, but the tide is going to wash it out in 6 hours. And this is the sense here. Why are you thinking that your activity and your effort is going to have any lasting impact? Because the tide's going to wash you out too, and unless something eternal has happened in you and through you, you really didn't count for anything. And so what's the point of living? And the point is there's no point in living that way. Sometimes I have people ask me when I'm counseling them, and they are in the point of despair. And they say, a regular question I ask is, when is the last time you seriously considered taking your life? And sometimes it's not in the too distant past, last hour or whatever. And I say, you've come to the right conclusion. Life lived the way you're living isn't worth living. I agree with you. Right conclusion. Wrong solution, but right conclusion. Sometimes they ask me, have you ever considered suicide? And I said, no. Homicide has been my temptation. Maybe I love myself too much, but I've considered killing other people, but I haven't considered killing myself. Life is brief. Life is boring. Verses 8 to 11, and things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. All of this is boring. I've heard this all, and just boring. Folks, did you know that life is supposed to be boring without God? It is supposed to be that way. So if you're a teenager or an adult running around saying, boy, this is boring. Again, that's a greater reflection on you than it is on mom and dad. They're not giving you a lot of activity. That means your brain's dead. And your relationship with God is not very vibrant for you to be bored. There is too much ministry in the world, too much preparation for ministry in the world, too much to do for God to ever be bored. And he says, all things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. Which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. You know, think about life. You know, I was talking with somebody about administration and management. He says, well, I spend so much time just fixing problems. I said, this is what administration is on a fallen planet. You're plugging thumbs in the dice and tying up loose ends and all this kind of thing. And there's not a lot of fun in that unless your enjoyment is just the fact that God has redeemed you and given you something to do for His glory, and He's blessing what you're doing. That's where the joy is. There's no joy in tying up loose ends and plugging dikes. It's all administrivia. And it's flat boring most of the time. And your heart will say, what's the use of all this? What's the point? And there isn't any point in doing it the way you're doing it. God's not energizing your life. And there's no point in doing it the way you're doing it. Life will be boring. Verse 10. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new, it hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, and that's the same word as generations back in verse 4. There's no remembrance of former generations, neither shall there be any remembrance of generations that are to come with those that shall come after. So life is going to be very brief, and it's going to be very boring. You're going to say, this is just all a bunch of labor. And Solomon is saying, now what's the point of life, folks, if this is the way it is? I like what Solomon is doing here, and he'll do this several times throughout the book, and that is he will appeal to nature. And we'll say, consider something of nature. He said, consider the wind here. It goes in its circuits, and the sun goes in its circuits, and everything happens, and the water goes to the sea, and it comes back in the clouds again. And he says, consider all of this. And I mentioned in your notes there, reflection on nature is designed by God to humble man. It shows God's glory by its sheer vastness in size and power. We would be goaded more and not nearly as cocky if we spent more time just reflecting on nature, on creation. Some of you heard me tell this illustration before, but several years ago, I was able to speak at a Christian educators convention over in Hawaii. And somebody's got to do it. I mean, it's February. It's always in February. I get to go back there in 2004. First time I'd been to Hawaii, my host took me for a hike up Diamond Head Mountain. It's an extinct volcano, and you see Diamond Head. That's Diamond Head right up there. If you ever watched Hawaii 5-0 when you were a kid, you saw Diamond Head every week. So here's Diamond Head up here, and this is the view. This bottom thing is a view of Honolulu from the top of Honolulu, and this is what you're seeing over here when you're looking from down this direction. That's what's happening here in that thing. And I stood up there, and I haven't been around the ocean a lot. I grew up in South Dakota. You know, we have waves of grain. You know, but you know, that's about it. And it was dark. I flew over there in the middle of the night. Got there about 1 a.m. their time, and so the next day, I slept in, and the next day he took me on this hike. And got up to the top of there, and I looked at this vast expanse. Now, here I am, and I'm looking at ocean as far as I can see. There's just water. I thought, this is an amazing thing. And I said, and the tide was out. And he said, now, when the tide is in, it's going to come up. See where that line is right down there? The tide's going to come in there. And I thought, you know, this is an amazing thing. I thought, you know, when the kids were little and we had this 6-foot, 3-ring blow-up kiddie pool, and we'd fill that with water, and then about 4 or 5 days later, you would have to move it or it would kill the grass. And I thought of how much energy it took for me to move that 3-ring kiddie pool from, you know, just 6 feet over. You know, and you groan and you sweat and you pull, because water weighs 8 pounds a gallon. You know, there's a lot of pound in there. Usually you end up just kind of knocking down the side and a lot of water spills over, and then you come back and you can move it, and then you have to fill it up again, all that kind of thing. And I thought, you know, I take all of this energy to move that kiddie pool, and God is moving the oceans every 6 hours back and forth, and he doesn't even sweat. This is amazing power, folks. By the word of his power, this happens. And I remembered a news clip I had watched. There was something on the news about some movie that was coming out in the entertainment section in the news. There was some storm. I didn't even remember what it was. Some storm scene. And they showed in this news clip this pool that they had made to create this storm, and they had these huge hydraulic paddle were moving back and forth, and all of this machine make these huge waves for this film. And I thought, you know, amazing technology and hydraulics and all of this, control systems and everything in that, and I thought, and I was standing on top of Diamond Head, and I thought, you know, God whips up hurricanes out here by the word of his power. No huge paddles. He just says, Hurricane Adna, come to pass, you know, whatever he says, and there it is, wreaking devastation wherever it goes. Now, folks, this is amazing power. This is who we're dealing with. This is who is our God, who loves us. And we give so very little consideration for him. And Solomon is saying, look, just consider a little bit about nature here. And another thing just about our solar system and the Milky Way. David said, when I consider the heavens, the works of thy hands, he says, the conclusion I come to is, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Why do you even pay attention to us down here with all of that out there? That is amazing. Our solar system in itself is a vast system, but it's minuscule compared to the rest of space. In fact, they measure space in AUs, astronomical units. 1 AU equals 93 million miles. That's the distance from here to the sun. If you've ever traveled that recently, it's 93 million miles. Pluto's orbit is 39.44 AUs. And they say interstellar space begins at 100 AUs, 100 times the distance of from here to the sun. And our solar system is just one star. Has one star, the sun, and it's part of the Milky Way galaxy. You can see that little photo that I took when I was out there traveling. That's a vacation photo right there of the Milky Way. No. And the Milky Way is a group of 20 galaxies, which is just the local group, they call it. The local group of galaxies. This is staggering stuff. You know, I can't even fathom this. But our God made it by His words. And sometimes I remember as a college student just thinking about this sometimes, about space, and thinking, let's say I am way out here in one of these things, and all of these stars, and then if you go into this one little cluster of pieces of dirt, and you have our solar system, and you have our galaxy. And in all of those planets, then you have the Earth. And you focus down on a little further, and in the Earth you have all of these continents, and they pick out North America. And down in North America, there's a state called South Carolina. And in South Carolina, there's a city called Greenville. And in Greenville, there's a campus called Bob Jones University. And in Bob Jones University, there's a room called Smith 223. And that's where I live. And God knows I'm here. That's amazing, folks. And He cares. And He's got all of that other stuff out there, but He cares about us. Now, if you forget that, you'll go into despair. And you're supposed to, if you forget that. I remember one time as a freshman, I was working at the information desk, one of the first times I was working alone Saturday morning. And Dr. Bob Jr., I didn't know he was in the building, but he walked out of the executive wing, walked in front of the information desk to go out the door to go to the art gallery. First Saturday morning I'd worked. I'm a freshman. He walked by the information desk and greeted me and said, "Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?" I about swallowed my bubble gum. I wasn't chewing gum. But this guy, and I thought, this man knows my name. And I didn't say, "Well, of course he knows my name." I wasn't impressed with me that he knew. I was impressed with him. And it's an impressive thing that God knows our names, folks. And if you ever forget that, it will lead you to despair. And it's supposed to. This is why I say in your notes, reflection on nature is designed by God to humble man. It shows God's glory by its sheer vastness in size and power. Solomon said, I saw all of this great emptiness, but I also saw that people were expending great energy. In verse 13, and he said, "And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under the heaven." This sore travail, or this sorry duty, this sorry task, hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. This word labor here, sore travail, means the energy that is expended to make something happen. Sore travail there, as I mentioned, means sorry task, or better, just means sorrowful. This sorrowful task is that God, as your notes say, the sorry task or the burden is that God prompts men to seek, but there is no apparent answer. This restlessness is a God-given goad. That word that's translated sore travail is translated 28 other times in the scriptures. Sometimes as 28 times as labor. Other renderings include misery, miserable, sorrow, trouble, mischief, weariness, toil. The concept is energy with sorrow. You expend a lot of energy in life, but it still doesn't feel good. Would you turn back to Genesis 3? And let's find out why. This is the problem, folks. If you don't recognize why life doesn't taste good, you're going to think what you need to do is change jobs. Or you're going to think what you need to do is change wives or husbands or change addresses or change dads. and just run away. If you think that that's why you're miserable, you're going to make a lot of foolish decisions. That's not why you're miserable if you're miserable. And because we're very earthling-like and we think like humans, I remember one time Kirsten was about 6 years old and she was doing something and she said, well, if I do this, I said, honey, you know what the problem with that is? You're thinking like a human being. And she said, well, Daddy, I am one. I said, I know you are, honey, but you have to think like God. Because that's your problem. You're thinking like a human being right now. Folks, if you think that the problem is with your job or the problem is with your wife or the problem is with your health or the problem is with whatever, that that's why you're so miserable in your soul and so sorrowful in your soul, you don't understand life. Look at Genesis 3, verse 16. God says to the woman, and to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy what? Sorrow. And thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. Now God isn't saying, all right, you're cursed, woman. You sinned. You have to have babies. That's not the curse. She was designed by God to have babies before the curse. Before the fall. The curse was that in sorrow this would happen. Verse 17, and unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake, in sorrow thou shalt eat of it all the days of thy life. He didn't say, all right, Adam, you sin, you have to work. He had given him responsibilities before the fall. Work wasn't the curse. Sorrow in work is the curse. What is sorrow? Sorrow is an emotion of loss. Anytime you think about something that you have lost, if it was important to you, your heart grieves. It sorrows. It has what we say, pain. It's supposed to be that way. Pain. Sorrow is like throbbing is pain in the toe when you drop something on your toe. It's supposed to hurt when somebody drops a cement block on your toe. That gives warning that something is not the way it's supposed to be right now, and something needs to be done to correct it. Get the block off the toe. That's the little message that pain is giving the body at that time. And when you're experiencing sorrow, pain in your soul, it's saying to you, life isn't the way God intended for it to be right now. You know, when somebody dies, when my dad died, I remember after I got all the arrangements made and with mom and got that worked out, I came home it was the next day after he died. And I got home and I was alone and I cried like a baby. It hurt. It's sorrow. This isn't the way God intended it to be. He intended us to be with Him forever without death. And every time you experience the sorrow, it ought to remind you, this isn't the way God meant it to be. And that's not bad for us to sorrow. It's when we sorrow without hope that we go to despair. Despair is sorrow without hope. If you lose something that's important to you, it ought to hurt. But we sorrow not, Paul said in 1 Thessalonians, as those who have no hope. Yes, it hurts down here. That's part of the curse. But what we do, instead of turning to God and saying, God, this death, this sinfulness, this is not the way you meant it to be, and I long for it to be like you want it to be, in my own life now as much as possible, and someday in eternity with you. But even in all this sorrow right now, I have great hope because you are my God, and you are my joy. And if you don't do that, you will sorrow without hope in this world, and you will despair, and you're supposed to despair if you don't have God in your thoughts. Picture Solomon is painting is that you can build your sandcastle, but the tide will sweep it away, and while you're doing that, you will experience a great deal of heaviness or sorrow, knowing that something is incomplete. And our spouse leaves us, or our spouse betrays us, or our spouse abuses us, or our spouse does something else, and you know what? It hurts. And you know what? It's supposed to hurt, because things aren't supposed to be that way. But then we start sorrowing and we get angry. Instead of turning to God in dependence and saying, oh God, I know that the sorrow in my heart is because you designed it to be this way on a fallen planet, to point me back to you. I need you to inject joy of your spirit in my life, because right now I am heavy in heaviness through manifold temptations, 1 Peter says. But Peter also says, in this you greatly rejoice, that you have a living hope, though you are in heaviness through manifold temptations. Instead, we get angry and we lash out and we create sorrow for other people and more guilt for ourselves, and we just spiral down and down. Well, Solomon's, that's his misery. I saw great energy expended. I saw great emptiness in it. Oh, here's, I mentioned a couple of things about sorrow. Sorrow is the emotion of loss when I think about my loss. Now, it can be something you shouldn't have had in the first place. Let's say that there's a guy dating an unsaved girl, and God removes her from her life. Is he going to sorrow over that if she meant a lot to him? Yes. But he shouldn't have wanted that in the first place. God removes some things from us that we shouldn't have. He removes some things from us that are just part of the living life on a fallen planet, and it just hurts. Despair, as I mentioned, is sorrowing without hope. Now, if somebody comes to you down, don't just try to make them feel good and say, well, you need to change activities, or you need to do this, or you need to change this, or you need to take this, or you need to do that. Look, find out where the loss is in their life. They're supposed to sorrow. Sorrow leads us to God. If you just divert it or drug it, they never get to God, because it dulls the pain. And the pain is designed, as you're going to find hammering out again and again in this book, the pain is designed to point us to God. And if you won't go to God, you're supposed to feel the sting. So he set out on a mission. He says, I have to find out some answers for this myself. And he's going to share with these philosophers, this is what I found. And let's look at his qualifications. So chapter 1, verse 12 to 18. He says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity or empty and vexation of spirit or chasing after wind. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is wanting cannot be numbered. He said, you know what I found out? If God makes it crooked, you can't straighten it out, and if he didn't make it, you can't count it. Verse 16, I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Now, what is he saying there? He's saying, I'm the ruling king in Jerusalem. I've diligently applied myself to this question. Point C in your notes, he had carefully observed all that pertained to this question. Point D, he had acquired more wisdom and knowledge than most other people. And point E, he found much grief and sorrow in things as they were. And a man on this planet is going to have a heavy heart. The more you deal with other people, I mean, my heart is heavy all the time. It sorrows all the time. Because we're dealing with marriages and young people who have trashed their lives. And when you sit in and listen to that and try to help them, your heart is heavy. This isn't the way God intended it to be. And if you have your heart open and you're reflecting on life and your own life and other people's life, you will always have a heavy heart. Does that mean that you have to walk around with your chin dragging on the ground? No. Joy and heaviness can abide in the same heart. Count it all joy. If even though you're in manifold temptations, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. You know, Peter and James, you know they worked together as co-pastors in Jerusalem because they said the same things. And yes, life has heaviness, and I'm not minimizing any of that heaviness. And I'm saying, don't let the heaviness drive you to anger and frustration and bitterness. Make it drive you to God. And we'll get to that point as we go along through this week. The last statement there in your notes before point two says, wisdom, when viewed apart from that wisdom which comes from the fear of God, increases grief instead of bringing relief to the question of profit. So what is his quest? Here is where the question comes in. Are we having fun yet? He says, here's what I did. I labored at expending wealth. And so what did he do? Verses 1 to 3, he partied. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of mirth, what doeth it? What's its point? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet in my words, and to hold on folly, till I might see what that was good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. He partied, he experimented, he stimulated his senses, guarding against any excesses. He tried to fill the restlessness. He said, let's do something, let's party. And he said, that didn't quench the sorrow. That didn't quench the heaviness. He partied, he built. Verses 4 to 6. I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made me pools of water to water wherewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. Now, he's not just saying, you know, I had a little kiddie pool out here, and I had some lions coming up, and I had a little pump, and it made water come out of the mouth of the lion into the pool. That's not the kind of pool. He's talking about enormous irrigation lakes several miles from Jerusalem to water his orchards. Here's what they were like. They were called Salmonic pools. The lower pool was 582 feet long, 207 feet wide, 50 feet deep. That's one of three. Second pool, middle pool, 423 feet long, 250 feet wide, 39 feet deep. And the upper pool, 380 feet long, 236 feet wide, 25 feet deep. That's a big irrigation ditch. He did a lot of building. It took 30,000 men to do all of his building. He not only built and partied, but he shopped. Boy, now that'll solve your despair, won't it? Like some people say, we have a lot of money, it's just tied up in debt. Verse 7. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of men. Talks harem right there. As musical instruments and that of all sorts. So he shopped. Remember, he had unlimited resources. His shopping included his harem. And he despaired. Verses 9 to 11. So I was great and increased more than all they that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Or he said, I didn't lose sight of my goal to evaluate all of this. In verse 10, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought and on the labor that I labored to do. And behold, all was vanity. The canvas was still empty and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. What's the point? And what he's saying, some of you guys out there, some of you philosophers have tried a lot of this stuff too, and if you're honest with yourself, it didn't do anything for you either. So, he comes up with a couple of goads. Number one, goad number one, pleasure doesn't satisfy. So then he explored wisdom. He wanted to find, and this is not biblical wisdom. This is just a lot of logical philosophizing. Better understood as logic or reasoning here, exploring cause and effect of things. Not necessarily speaking, as I said, of godliness, but the best conclusions a rational man can come up with. Verses 12 to 13, and I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king? He said, look, I have a chance to look. I've got a scope of looking over and investigating all kinds of stuff. I mean, he's the king. He's got internet. Nobody else has internet. He has access to all kinds of things other people don't have access to. And he says, I looked at it all. Verse 13, then I saw that wisdom excelleth folly as far as light excelleth darkness. He said, you know what I learned? If you want it, folly doesn't work. But verse 14 to 19, I also learned that knowledge doesn't last. The wise man's eye, verse 14, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happened to them all. He said, okay. So I learn all this stuff, and the fool around the corner doesn't learn any of this, and both of us die. What's the point of all of my knowledge? And you know what the point is? There is no point of all your knowledge without God. Verse 15, then said I in my heart, as it happened to the fool, so it happened even to me. In other words, we both died. And why was I then more wise? If I really was wise, I wouldn't be dying. Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. And so you philosophers out there that he's writing to, said, you can talk about all your worldviews and collect it all together, but you're going to die. Then what? What's the point? Verse 16, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than the fool forever. You're not going to make any bigger splash than the fool that dies. Seeing that that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? As the fool. I can spend all this time pursuing logic and reasoning and philosophy, but the best conclusion I can come out of that is that it's better to be wise than a fool, but you're both going to die and your knowledge doesn't last. So what's the point? And then he despaired. Verse 17, therefore I hated life because the work that was wrought under the sun is grievous unto me, or sorrowful, for all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. And who knoweth whether he be a wise man or a fool? Accumulate all this knowledge, accumulate all this wealth, leave it to the next generation, and that guy spends it all or throws it away. What's the point? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor, wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. About to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. He despaired. Verse 20 to 23. Verse 21 there. He says, For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom, like he was looking for, philosophy, and in knowledge and in equity. Yet to a man that hath not laboreth, therein shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what hath man of all his labor and of the vexation of his heart, whereof he hath labored under the sun? For all his days are sorrows, and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This also is vanity. He said, you know what? When I think about this, when I really spend time thinking about where all of this is headed, I don't even sleep at night. He says, my heart taketh no rest in the night. Folks, if you can't sleep, there's a reason for that. Now, I'm not saying if you don't have, you can have an endocrine problem or splitting headache or something else like that. But most of us who can't sleep are not sleeping because we're experiencing the way down that we talked about last night. I gave you a thing about that. We are dissatisfied with something, and we're anxious because we can't have it, and we're despairing perhaps even that we're not going to get it. And you know what? If you dwell on those things, you're not supposed to sleep. You're not supposed to have rest. I keep telling folks, when your soul is at rest, your body will rest. Go work on your soul. Deal with the problem. Don't just override the symptoms. I haven't met anyone who didn't have a true physical cause of that. I'm not talking about psychiatric causes of sleeplessness. I'm talking about true physical causes. Who, if they would be honest with their life and with you about it, we didn't find out why they weren't sleeping. Now, I'm not saying it's always an easy answer, but it's going to be found in this way down. Well, does that mean they have a spiritual problem? Yes! So did Solomon. That's what he's saying. When I consider all of this stuff and the way life is going and the way it's turning out, I can't even sleep at night. And you know what? You're not supposed to sleep at night. When that's the way you're thinking. We are supposed to sleep at night. Rest is a wonderful thing. The older I get, the more I love sleep. It's a wonder. Solomon, I know Solomon says in Proverbs not to love sleep. I think that means over other things or whatever, but sleep is nice. Folks, understand what I'm saying here. Despair isn't bad. Sleeplessness isn't bad when you're watching, when you're finding out why it is there. It's a goad to make you consider, why is life so empty for me? Is it because I don't have this and I don't have that and so-and-so walked away from me and I'm being mistreated? That isn't why life is sad. That will create sorrow. But the hopelessness, the despair comes because God is not in your sights in all of this. They're warnings, they're goads, that life has to be approached differently. So the question here is, are we having fun yet? Maybe not. Solomon says, I partied, I built, I did all of these things, but I still couldn't sleep. I considered, who's going to get this next? He's probably going to be a fool, throw it away. What's the point of all of this? And the point is, there is no point of that. So let's not dismiss the despair in our lives. Let's not dismiss the restlessness. Let's not dismiss the sleeplessness and try to divert our attention into something else and handle it some other way. Let's take a good hard look at where we are trying to find satisfaction in our life. And if it is not directly in relationship with a living God, it's supposed to taste bad. The conclusion. Are you frequently bored and empty or restless and agitated? Does your labor seem to you like you are chasing after wind? Do you despise the routine and constraints of life? Is all your adult life? Are you frequently depressed and discouraged? Do you often feel alone, rejected, and abandoned? Do you look for action because you have a hard time when left by yourself? Are you afraid to be by yourself because your thoughts when alone are too painful? If any of these describe your experience in life, you are being goaded by God to stop living the way you live. God is saying, you big ox, don't you feel my goads? Get moving. Live life the way I designed it. Now, let's not go around calling each other big oxes, but I think you get the imagery there. He's saying, folks, move a different way. Now, this is the point where some folks will get very angry and say, but you don't understand my pain. I probably don't unless we sat down and spent a lot of time. But I spend a lot of time listening to a lot of pain. I think I understand pain. But folks, we don't divert ourselves away from that pain. We begin to understand, where is this goad coming from? There is an answer to this. Now, it's not going to come for about two or three more nights. So we're going to have two or three more nights of goading before we get to some solutions. As I said, there are a lot of goads in this book, very few nails. We're going to find the nails, and they're going to be a great help. But in the meantime, folks, we're supposed to feel the goad. That's not bad. But in our American way of life, we think anytime we feel bad, we've got to change that. We've got to go find some way to change that and make it so I can't think about it or I don't think about it because I just don't like feeling this way. That we are supposed to make a change. It is a goad. But the change is going to be one of dependence that we're going to talk about Friday and Saturday. But don't just avoid the rest of it. Now say, I can't take any more of this. You're already doing surgery without anesthesia. And I don't want any more of this stuff. You have to have more of this. Solomon spent a whole book on it. God intended for us to have a whole book of it before we come to the solution. Our problem is we don't want to look at this hard enough to really come about with some permanent change in our life. As I said, there is no book that has more changed the way I think about life than Ecclesiastes. And it takes 11 chapters of goads to get you to that point. Don't shortcut the goads. We've got to have them. We've got to think about them. This is Solomon's misery. He says, I feel like I'm chasing after wind. My sandcastle is being washed away every time. And his mission is to find an answer to the despair. And the next session, tomorrow night, we're going to start with the message, what he learned from this. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, you understand this planet because you came down here yourself. And you are a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from you. And you were despised. And you were rejected of men. And Lord Jesus, you are the one who was wounded for our transgressions and bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon you, and by your stripes we are healed. And we know that you have borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and you understand this kind of pain because you lived here and because you're omniscient and know it anyway. And I pray that your people here might not be despairing as we look at all of these goads, that they might realize how much we need you. Lord Jesus, thank you for coming to this planet. Thank you for living here among us and being tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin, so that you could say to us to come boldly before your throne of grace to find grace to help and mercy in this time of need. And I pray for those in our midst who are despairing. Relationships have gone sour. Dreams have been crushed. Things have not gone well. But may you, by your Spirit, breathe hope to their weary souls, because you are the answer. You don't just have answers for us, you are the answer. And may they find you this week in fellowship in a new and in a special way. And may they walk in joy, even though they experience much sorrow. Help us to that end, Father, for we pray it in your name. Amen.